John 15, Part 1, Verses 1 through 11, Abide in the Vine, was presented by Jack Crabtree on July 15, 2001, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2001. Gutenberg College is a non-profit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side.
I would like to look at John chapter 15. Look at the first 11 verses. Maybe we can come back and look at the rest of the chapter later, but I don't think we'll get past the first 11 verses this morning. There's actually several different things that have brought me to this passage, and I don't know if I can keep them all sorted out. So let me tell you what I'm interested in, and probably as I speak this morning, I'll weave these three different themes together. The first thing that interests me in this passage is the question of what exactly is the role of the Bible in our lives as believers, because this was brought home to me this past year. I've been having a Bible study, or for most of last year, I had a Bible study in Corvallis, and one of the people who attended this Bible study was an intriguing young woman from Romania, a Hungarian woman from Romania, don't ask, who's a doctoral student in mathematics at Oregon State, and she was very intrigued by the Bible study for about half the year, but about halfway through we got together and she was deeply disturbed because the picture of the faith that I was painting was different than her picture of the faith. And she brought me here to John 15 to see what I would do with John 15, because in her mind, whether or not I was really teaching Christianity, whether or not I was really teaching Jesus, hinged on what I was going to do with John 15. In her mind, this was a litmus test as to whether I was really a Christian. What I'm interested in is what you do with John 15 is a litmus test as to what you do with the Bible. So that's going to be one of the things I want to look at, and one of the things I want to think about here this morning as we look at this chapter. The other thing, a second theme, is what exactly is going on in biblical interpretation? How do we decide what a passage means? And there's some important issues that are raised here in John 15 that I think I'd like to kick around. And then, of course, the third thing is, what does John 15 mean? And what is its message to us? So I'm going to start there and then try to interject comments on those other two themes as we go. I think that's how it'll work. And hopefully, I will be able to leave plenty of time for questions here. This is a familiar passage. You've heard this, I'm sure. I am the true vine, and my Father is the vine dresser. Every branch in me that does not bear fruit, he takes away, and every branch that bears fruit, he prunes it so that it may bear more fruit. You are already clean because of the word which I have spoken to you. Abide in me, and I in you. As the branch cannot bear fruit of itself unless it abides in the vine, so neither can you unless you abide in me. I am the vine, you are the branches. He who abides in me and I in him, he bears much fruit, for apart from me you can do nothing. If anyone does not abide in me, he is thrown away as a branch and dries up, and they gather them and cast them into the fire, and they are burned. If you abide in me and my words abide in you, ask whatever you wish, and it will be done for you. My Father is glorified by this, that you bear much fruit, and so prove to be my disciples. Just as the Father has loved me, I have also loved you. Abide in my love. If you keep my commandments, you will abide in my love, just as I have kept my Father's commandments and abide in his love. These things I have spoken to you, so that my joy may be in you, and that your joy may be made full. Okay, actually, let me start with the interpretive issue here, because right off the bat, it becomes critical how you think about what a passage means. One of the things that I've been impressed with over the years of studying the Bible is the role, is how malleable, how plastic, how flexible language is. Oftentimes the critics of the Bible say, the Bible, you can make it say whatever you want it to say. It's an exaggerated claim, but there's an element of truth in that. And as you look around, look at all the different Christians, look at all the different denominations, look at all the different people who claim to be believers and claim to be grounding their beliefs in the Bible, and notice what vastly different conclusions they arrive at about what the faith is, what a given passage means, what doctrines are true doctrines, and so on. And they're all over the map. Why can they be all over the map? If they're looking at the same book, reading the same book, interested in the same thing, how come they come up with such radically different conclusions? Well, the answer ultimately is because this is in language, and language is plastic. We are imaginative, intelligent, rational human beings who are able to go to work on something and create out of what looks like chaos a coherence of our own. We will make an understanding of the first 11 verses of chapter 15 of John a coherent picture somehow. Is it what Jesus intended? That's another question. But is it plausible, and is it coherent, and is it intelligent, and does it make some sort of sense? Well, sure. My interpretation was calculated to be plausible and rational and intelligent. So what that means is any given passage, take these 11 verses, are going to be subject to a variety of different interpretations depending upon what ahead of time I expect the passage to be saying. And that's informed by my doctrine, by my tradition, by my personal desires and values and wishes. All kinds of things create in me a certain expectation about what a given passage is going to mean. I've already ruled out some things as obviously not true. There's other things that are in the realm of possibility, and I'm going to create an interpretation of this passage that fits in the range of what I think it might possibly be saying. We all operate that way, without exception. And it's not to our fault that we operate that way. That's just part of what it means to be a rational human being. I know it's not going to be saying something not true. I've already decided that when I decided that the Bible is my authority, that whatever it's saying is true. I already know some things that are true, at least I think I do. I already know some things that are true. So it's not going to be teaching any of those things that I know are not true. And those I don't even consider. Those I leave out. It's not a bad thing that we do that. It's efficient, it's economical, it's rational that we operate that way. But we have to recognize that that's the way we operate. We are allowing my preconceptions, my pre-understanding, to shape how I'm looking at a passage. In this passage, there are two very obvious different pictures of what Jesus is seeking to accomplish that we bring to the text from the get-go that make a huge difference how we look at this. Most of us are very comfortable with the theology that I have in the past called Star Wars theology. We're very comfortable with that. We expect the Bible to be teaching that. We have been told that the Bible teaches that. We think it's orthodox, a part of our orthodox Christian faith that the Bible teaches that. So we are ready to read that into this passage. And for years, that's the way I read this passage. In fact, it hasn't been until the last couple of years that I've even reconsidered John 15. Taken that way, look at a very obvious, plausible interpretation. I am the true vine, and my Father is the vine dresser. Every branch in me that does not bear fruit, he takes away, and every branch that bears fruit, he prunes it so that it may bear more fruit. Let's kind of ignore that. That becomes a problem to my interpretation. Let's get on to what's interesting. You are already clean because of the word which I have spoken to you, part of the not so interesting. Now it gets interesting in verse 4. Abide in me, and I in you, as the branch cannot bear fruit of itself unless it abides in the vine, so neither can you unless you abide in me. Now, why is that interesting to me? It sounds exactly what I already know is true. What I already know is true is that Jesus, having ascended to the right hand of God on high, has become a cosmic power source. The Spirit of Jesus, which is one and the same as the Holy Spirit, the Spirit of God, has become to us a kind of cosmic power source. And I'm either plugged into that power source, in which case I am energized and empowered to accomplish what God would want me to accomplish, however I define that, or I'm not plugged into that power source, you know, and energized to be able to accomplish whatever God wants me to accomplish. One or the other is true. If I'm plugged into Jesus, then Jesus is filling me with his power and strength and energy. If I'm not plugged into Jesus, then I'm devoid of the power and energy that Jesus can supply. And that, therein lies the secret. Therein lies the key to the Christian life. Stay plugged into Jesus. That's exactly what John is saying here, right? Abide in me, and I will abide in you. You stay plugged into me, and I will stay filling you. This seems to be verified as we go on. The branch cannot bear fruit of itself. In and of myself, I am devoid of any power. It's only when I'm supplied power by Jesus that I am empowered to bear fruit, however I understand that. So, just as the vine can't bear fruit without being plugged into the vine, I can't bear fruit spiritually without being plugged into Jesus. I am the vine, you are the branches. He who abides in me and I in him, he bears much fruit. But apart from me, you can do nothing. And we could go on and look, that's the key to it. If that's my expectation theologically for what Jesus is saying here, certain verses come into the foreground and other verses fade into the background. They're just kind of throwaway verses. Yeah, Jesus said it, but yeah, it means something. If pressed, you say, well, why did he say that? I'll come up with some intelligent, rational, plausible understanding of why he said that, given that his basic point was to proclaim Star Wars theology. But let's shift gears. What if Jesus doesn't believe in Star Wars theology? What if that's not what he's saying? What if that's not what he's trying to teach? What if his whole point is something radically and entirely different than that? Well, let's look at it. Here's my proposal. What gets my attention right off the bat is this claim, I am the true vine. What does he mean, true vine? Why true vine? If he's teaching Star Wars theology, all that's required is that he be metaphorically equated to a vine and that we be metaphorically equated to the branches of that vine, because it doesn't matter whether you're the true vine or not the true vine, the branches of your vine need you to have life. So all he requires for that teaching is that he have this metaphor going between the vine and the branches. So what does the true vine contribute to anything? It's the first question I ask myself about this. The second thing that we might notice is that the image of a vine comes up in some pretty prominent places in the prophets. Let me just read you one passage. This is in the 5th chapter of Isaiah. Let me sing now for my well-beloved, a song of my beloved concerning his vineyard. My well-beloved had a vineyard on a fertile hill. He dug it all around, removed its stones, and planted it with the choicest vine. And he built a tower in the middle of it, and also hewed out a wine vat in it. Then he expected it to produce good grapes, but it produced only worthless ones. And now, O inhabitants of Jerusalem and men of Judah, judge between me and my vineyard. What more was there to do for my vineyard that I have not done in it? Why, when I expected it to produce good grapes, did it produce worthless ones? So now let me tell you what I am going to do to my vineyard. I will remove its hedge, and it will be consumed. I will break down its wall, and it will become trampled ground. I will lay it waste. It will not be pruned or hoed, but briars and thorns will come up. I will also charge the clouds to rain no rain on it. For the vineyard of the Lord of hosts is the house of Israel, and the men of Judah his delightful plant. Thus he looked for justice, but behold, bloodshed, for righteousness, but behold, a cry of distress. The point of that passage, of course, is to liken Israel to a, on the one hand, a vineyard, and he switches the metaphor to a plant itself, to an actual vine. That vineyard is, Israel is to God like some vineyard, some precious vineyard is to the, what, the vintner, the farmer. That image comes up a few times in the prophets. Ezekiel talks about, it's as if God had this house and there was this vine that he was nurturing that it was his precious and beloved vine that would offer shade in summer and fruit, and his guests would enjoy the vine. I'm not sure how much I'm reading into it and how much was actually in Ezekiel, but that's the image, the impression that I got. It seems to me that that's what Jesus is hearkening back to. We know from the prophets that one thing we can understand about, one angle that we can use for understanding what God is doing in the world and God is doing in history, is that God is working in history like a farmer cultivates a vine. God is committed to a vine to make it the best possible vine it could be, to be what he wants it to be, to create something that will bring him delight, that will bring him pleasure, and that will accomplish his purposes. The prophets liken that vine to Israel. What is God doing in the world? He's chosen this vine, and he's seeking to cultivate it because he wants it to bear fruit. He wants grapes off of this vine. And everything that he's doing, he's dug a cistern, he's put up a wall, he's put a tower in the midst of it. He's doing everything a good farmer would do to protect his vineyard and cultivate it so that it produces grapes for his enjoyment and his delight. That's what Israel is. Jesus is coming along and I think making an incredibly, profoundly radical claim. You want to know who the real vine is? Me. I'm the real vine. It's not just Israel. Yeah, that's true. God was working in Israel. God had purposes for Israel. He was setting out to accomplish his purposes in Israel. But if you want to know who the true vine is, I'm the true vine. I'm the main deal. I'm what God is seeking to accomplish in history. I am what it's all about. All of God's energy, all of God's care, all of God's purposes are focused on accomplishing something in and through me. I'm where it's at. I think that's the significance of his claim, I'm the true vine. I'm the true vine, my Father is the vine dresser, exactly what the imagery that you have in the prophets with respect to Israel. I'm the true vine, my Father is the vine dresser, literally farmer, just the farmer who cares for the vine. Every branch in me that does not bear fruit, he takes away, and every branch that bears fruit, he prunes it so that it may bear more fruit. Okay, what's his point? His point is that I'm the main deal, and God is all about accomplishing something in and through me. There's one and only one criteria that the farmer, God, is going to use with respect to how you relate to me. If you bear fruit, you're associated with me. You're on my side. You're with me. You're part of this vine. You're part of this thing that God is doing. You're part of the purposes that God is wanting to accomplish in history. If you don't bear fruit, you're worthless to him. You're not accomplishing his purposes, and if you're not accomplishing his purposes, he has no interest in you. Because his agenda is to accomplish specific purposes to his delight through Jesus. Are you in or are you out? You make up your mind. Where are you relative to him? And what makes the difference? Are you bearing fruit? That's the criteria. You are, my translation has, you are already clean because of the word which I have spoken to you. It's difficult to know exactly what he means right here. Already, I don't think, is a good translation. The word that's translated already, I think the root idea of the word is just now. And then depending upon the context, why am I stressing the now? Well, in different contexts, that has different connotations. If I say, I don't have an example ready at hand, but we can use now where what we mean is, so far it's true, who knows about the future? In which case, in English, we might translate it, so far. Because our emphasis is the uncertainty about the future relative to the certainty about the now. But what we might just use the word now to stress, right now as we speak, it is this way, and then implied, never stated explicitly, who knows about the future. Well, we would translate that, so far. If I say something is true now, and it's surprising that it is now and not later, then we are going to translate it already. Something is true already. Or I may say that something is true, I may not have any connotation like that. I'm just talking about in the moment, regardless of the past or the future, in the moment this is the case. And the same word in Greek is going to be used for all different three comments. So we have a choice to make here about what it means in this context. I'm more inclined to take it as so far in this verse. You are, so far you are clean because of the word which I have spoken to you. The reason I'm tempted to go that way is because immediately he turns, and I think he's speaking to his disciples. He's speaking to the 11 that are left. One of them is split. But he's speaking to the 11 who are left, and immediately he says, abide in me and I in you, as the branch cannot bear fruit of itself unless it abides in the vine, so neither can you unless you abide in me. And he goes on to talk about what's going to happen if you don't abide in me. You're going to be thrown out and burned in the pile just like a worthless dead branch. Well, why would he be saying that to these 11 disciples? Unless he understands that there's a theoretical possibility that they're going to split on him. They're not going to abide. They're not going to remain. They're not going to stay. They're not going to faithfully persist in being his disciples. They're eventually going to run into something that Jesus teaches that outrages them, and they say, I'm out of here. This guy's a wacko, and they're no longer following him. That's a theoretical possibility. I think with that theoretical possibility in mind, what he's saying is, you 11 have hung in there with me, and I've spoken some hard things. I think that's what he means by in view of or because of the word which I have spoken to you. So far you're clean. That is to say, so far you look to me like branches that the farmer is pruning and trimming because there's life in you. So far you seem to be okay. Because I've given you the gospel, I've preached the gospel to you, and you haven't forsaken it. You haven't said that's not true, but rather you've embraced it and believed it and are following me in the light of that. So far, you're clean. But I don't think he's making any commitments about the future. Because he goes on to warn them. Abide in me and I in you. Okay, what does he mean, abide in me? In this context, in this way of looking at it, Jesus is the true vine. This is what God is actually doing. What does that mean? As John puts it in John, I am the true light that has come into the world and enlightened every man. Jesus is the one whom our Creator God sent into the world to tell us the truth, to shed light on the chaos of our existence and help us make sense out of it, so that we can know who God is, who we are, and what God is up to in relationship to us. He's the one that sheds light on that so that we can know. He's the one that put all the pieces together. The prophets gave us glimpses of what God was doing in fragments and bits and pieces. Jesus is the last prophet who comes into the world and finally puts all the pieces together adequately enough that we know what this is all about. But the question of human existence is, what am I going to do with what Jesus has said? What am I going to do with what he has revealed to us, this truth that he has told us? Am I going to say, yes, that's true? And that is so importantly true that I'm going to center my life on that truth. My life is going to be lived in the light of that truth. My life is going to be defined by that truth being true. We can respond that way, or we can go, no, I don't think so. You say it's true. I don't think so. And there's dozens of different ways that we can say no to the truth that Jesus brought into the world. Most of them do not appear like we're saying no. Most of the ways that we say no to Jesus' truth, revealed truth, is by saying yes and then ignoring it. We say yes with our mouth, but we say no with all of the deeds of our life, all of the choices of our life, all of the attitudes of our life. We're saying no to what Jesus has taught us. Or even with the words of our mouth, we say, yes, that's true. And then we go on to explain the truth that Jesus taught us, and it doesn't even resemble what Jesus actually said. It's something entirely transformed. It's another gospel. That's what was behind my comment the other day following Ron's teaching on the prayer of Jabez. What I'm more and more impressed with is how much this culture that we live in of Bible-believing Christianity doesn't believe the Bible, doesn't read the Bible, is not even really particularly interested in reading the Bible, not really. What we want is what we want. What we want is the gospel that we want to hear, and by gum, we're going to find some way that the Bible is teaching us what we want to hear. And we'll go to any length to make it, to transform the biblical teaching into the image of the gospel that we want. Not the image of the gospel, not the gospel that Jesus taught us, that the light of the world came into the world to proclaim to us, not that one, but this other one that we prefer. And it, what Jesus is talking about to his disciples is, you have all kinds of options here. You know, you've been my disciples and you've heard what I have to say. You can either go out and faithfully believe that, embrace that, live your lives in the light of it and pass it on and transmit that truth that I have revealed to you. Or you can roll your own. You know, you can make it up. And you're going to, in the name of Jesus, in my name, you're going to proclaim it as what I came into the world to teach. You have a choice. But I'm telling you, you need to abide in me. Abide in me is stick with me, remain, and what he means by that fundamentally then is remain faithful to what I have passed on to you. Remain faithful to what I've revealed to you. Stick with that. Find it good enough. Don't get bored with it. Say, I want something new and different and more exciting. Stick with what I have proclaimed as true. Make that the most important truth in your life and just plug along living your life in the light of that and transmit that and teach that. Because if you stick with me, I will stick with you. Stay with me and I will stay with you is what he's saying. And what's the significance of that? If I'm the true vine, if I'm what God is really doing in the world and what God is really up to in the world, then you want to be with me. Believe me, you don't want to be anywhere else. You want to be with me because I'm what God is doing in the world. Abide in me and I in you, as the branch cannot bear fruit of itself unless it abides in the vine. Okay, what is he doing there? If we've already decided, if we're already tracking with Jesus, if we already have a glimpse of what he's saying now, Now we have to take what we know he's saying and interpret this phrase in the light of what we know he's already saying. As the branch cannot bear fruit of itself unless it abides in the vine. What is my metaphor? What is the significance of bearing fruit? The significance of bearing fruit is that you are seeing in your life the results that God has purposed to be there. You know, why does the farmer prune the vine to get grapes? Why does he want grapes? He's decided he likes grapes. They bring him joy. They bring him delight. They bring him pleasure. So that which God is calculating to accomplish, if you stick with Jesus, you're going to accomplish that. That's going to result in your life. That's going to be the effect in your life. If you don't stick with Jesus, there's no way in the world that you're going to produce any results that are going to bring the delight that God is looking for. And what that means is he will respond with displeasure to you, not with pleasure to you. Okay, so what is he saying here? He's not being specific about, you know, we I think misunderstand Jesus if we try to be definitive about what this fruit is. Are they souls that we win in evangelism? That's one of the things that people suggest. Are they the fruit of the Spirit? Love, joy, peace, and I can never get past that, but, you know, the rest of it. Is that the fruit that we're looking at? That's closer, and I think that's included in what he's talking about, but I don't think he's being that specific. All he's, in terms of the metaphor, all he's wanting to say is, we've got a farmer here who's growing up a vine because he wants grapes. Are you going to be able to produce any of the grapes that God wants if you don't stick with me? No. This is nothing about where the power source comes from. This is not use the force, Luke. This is not, tap into the Spirit, plug into the Spirit. That's not what Jesus is talking about. It's a different issue that he's addressing. And that is, can you be a God-fearing Jew who can find yourself in God's good pleasure and reject his Son? Nope. Jesus is making an audacious claim here. If this is not true of Jesus, this is an incredibly arrogant claim he's making here. He's saying there's no way on earth that you can reject what I have taught, that you can reject the truth that I have come into the world to reveal. No way in the world you can reject that and think that you can nevertheless be pleasing to your Father. That's going to be more and more a temptation in the world ahead of us. Just a little aside here. To the extent that we have a problem with Jesus and that we're hostile to his message and we're hostile to his claims and so on, to that extent, we're going to more and more want to redefine who Jesus was. Just a good teacher, just an accident of history. Who knows why he got all the attention that he did? He was just, you know, a plain old person, probably not a scam artist. He probably had good intentions, but, you know, just an accident of history that he became the big deal that he became. What's really important is that we love God. What's really important is that we experience God. What's really important is that we find God and know God. That's what's really important. Jesus doesn't have anything to do with that. Tremendous temptation confronts all of us and will continue to confront us in the future, because Jesus is the stumbling block. Jesus is drawing the line and calling a lot of people on the other side of that line, calling a lot of people out, and we're living in a world that doesn't like to call anybody on the outside. We love inclusive big tents, and Jesus' tent was pretty small. Was terribly small. And the more we feel the pressure, the more we feel the temptation, we're going to want to redefine Jesus and not abide in him. Not accept what he came into the world to actually tell us, but to reinvent the gospel to our liking. And that's exactly, explicitly, I think, what Jesus is telling us here not to do. Stick with me, and I will stick with you. Just like a branch in a vine, if it's a dead branch that's not bearing any grapes, what does a farmer do with it? He prunes it, breaks it off, lets it dry up, and burns it in the fire. It's not any good to him. You're not any good to God if you're not bearing fruit, and there's no way in the world that you can bear fruit that is of any value to God if you have not believed, embraced, and defined your life in the light of the truth that his Son Jesus brought into the world. That's what he's saying. I am the vine, you are the branches. He who abides in me and I in him, he bears fruit. For apart from me, you can do nothing of consequence and of value to God. Understood in the context. If anyone does not abide in me, he is thrown away as a branch and dries up, and they gather them and cast them into the fire, and they are burned. If you abide in me and my words abide in you, ask whatever you wish, and it will be done for you. 7, I think, is to be seen in contrast with 6. He's saying there's two kinds of people in the world. There are people who bear fruit, as he puts it, and people who don't bear fruit. If you don't bear fruit, what's the consequence? You are worthless to God, you'll be destroyed. But if you bear fruit, verse 7, if you abide in me, and he's already told us that by abiding in him you will bear fruit. If you abide in me, and my words abide in you, ask what you wish, and it will be done for you. Now, again, if we take this out of context, this becomes, you know, who of us in this world would not love for this to be Jesus teaching us, God has given you a credit card without any credit limit to go get anything you want to. If you just abide in me, then God gives you that credit card. Of course we want him to say that, and we have all kinds of Bible teachers who will tell you that that's what that verse is saying. But notice what he's doing. He's talking about the destiny of two different kinds of people. What is more likely? Isn't it more likely that what he's saying when he says, if you abide in me and my words abide in you, that is, if you stick with me and what I have taught you to believe, what I have taught you to value, what I have taught you to understand, and so on, is something that you have taken to heart, you've taken home, you've embraced it, and have internalized it. If that's the case, then God's going to give you what you want. And I would translate it that way, that God's going to give you what you want. And I would translate it that way because the whatever part of it is not at all clear. We've translated that into it. But it's not obvious that that's what he's saying, that whatever you want, you're going to get. What he's saying is that thing that you want, God is going to give to you. Well, what is that thing that you want? Well, if his words abide in you, if you have come to understand God the way he understands God and the way he has taught us to understand God, if you understand your lives the way Jesus has taught you to understand your lives, if you understand history, cosmic history, the way God has taught you to understand cosmic history, if you know what your existence is all about, and if you know what Jesus has taught you will truly fulfill you, then won't you want what you were created for? Isn't that going to be the desire of your heart? If his words abide in you? In other words, in shorthand, isn't it life in the kingdom of God that you want? Well, if you abide in me, he says, and my words abide in you, then that thing that you want, life in the kingdom of God, is yours. Eternal destruction because you're a worthless branch, or life in the kingdom of God that you were created for? Those are the two kinds of people. And what determines which you are? Do you abide in me or not? Do you remain my disciple or not? My Father is glorified by this, that you bear much fruit and so prove to be my disciples. That's what God is looking for to be his pride and joy, to be his honor. Jesus is the true vine, and we are the branches of the true vine. And the thing at the end of eternity that he wants to point to and say, see what I did? Look at that. It's this luxurious vine made up of Jesus and his disciples. That's what he's doing in the world. We are his pride and joy. And all of his efforts are directed at creating and nurturing and cultivating that vine. Just as the Father has loved me, I have also loved you. Abide in my love. From here on out, 9 through 11, I think he's just repeating himself, but he's repeating himself in different language. What does he mean by, just as the Father has loved me, I have also loved you? What does the love of the Father for the Son look like? God's love for his Son amounted to this, that he chose this creature, this human being, this single individual, he chose him to be the visible image of God himself, of the invisible God himself. He chose him to be that that incarnation of the divine being. And he destined him to be the eternal king of the eternal kingdom of God throughout the ages. That was God's love for his son. None of us are going to be given that blessing. None of us are going to be given that gift. Jesus is unique in that regard. Jesus has been uniquely loved by the Creator, by God the Creator. He gets to be king forever and ever and ever. Now, he had a little detour through the cross that he had to do to get there, but as Paul puts it in Philippians, for the joy set before him, he endured the cross. That he was willing to be obedient to the Father and suffer as the Father required of him. But why was he willing to go through that? Because the Father, in his love, had made him an incredibly grand promise. Obey me, follow me, and I will make you King of Kings and Lord of Lords. I think Jesus has that in view here. Just as the Father has loved me, I have also loved you. Just as God chose me for this glorious destiny, I have chosen you for a glorious destiny as well. I have chosen you to be a branch in me, using the metaphor. I have chosen you to be a citizen in the kingdom of God in which I will be king. And to be a citizen in that kingdom is an incredible blessing. So Jesus choosing us to that destiny is to have loved us. Just as the Father has loved me, I have also loved you. Stay in my love. Okay, what does he mean by that? I think he doesn't mean anything more or less, anything less, more complicated than just don't reject the promise that I've made to you. Don't reject the blessing that is in store for you. Don't reject the blessing that I have chosen you for. Stay with it. Make that the hope of your life. Make that the defining truth of your life. Don't be distracted by anything else. Remain in my love. Remain in that thing that in my love I have promised you. If you keep my commandments, and I would translate that instructions. Commandments is okay. I mean, this word certainly means commandments at times, but I think the New Testament writers use this word a little bit more loosely than we use the word commandments. For us, commandments is strictly an order of some kind. You know, you will do this, do this, do this, do this. But I think Jesus' commandments include everything that he revealed to us, truths that he revealed to us. This is what reality is, you guys. That's part of the commandments of Jesus. He's simply describing reality to us. But that has implied in it that we ought to live our lives in the light of that truth. And that's why it has the flavor, the character of a commandment, if you will, is because what Jesus has instructed us to do is something we ought to do. What Jesus has instructed us to believe is something that we ought to take to heart and allow that to dictate the way we live our lives. So, to keep his instructions is to take them to heart. If you take my instructions to heart, you will abide in my love. That is, you will remain with that hope of what I in my love have promised to you before you, just as I have kept my Father's instructions and abide in his love. In the same way that for the hope set before me, I will endure the cross, in the same way, I want you, for the hope that I have set before you, I want you to follow me. Remain faithful and suffer what you need to suffer. These things I have spoken to you so that my joy may be in you and that your joy may be made full. What was Jesus' joy? What was the joy of the man of sorrows? The joy of the man of sorrows was the hope set before him. He was quite willing to delay his pleasure, to delay his fulfillment, to delay joy. That is, even now in the midst of our lives of sorrow, the hope of eternal life, if we really believe it, and if we really want it, if it's really tangible to us, if it's really palpable to us, will have an emotional impact on our lives. It will settle our hearts. It will dampen despair. And we will be able to endure the sufferings of life, knowing that in the end, all is well. Everything is okay. There is a comfort, there is a pleasure, there is a delight that comes from knowing it's only a matter of time and all of my sorrows will cease. It's only a matter of time. And that brings this thing, I think, that Jesus is calling joy. Jesus says, I have that joy. And I want you to have it too, and I want you to have that made full. And that's why I'm telling you what your destiny is. I'm telling you that if you abide in me, you're abiding in my love. You're abiding in what I have lovingly promised you is your fulfillment, is your satisfaction, is your grand blessing one day. And knowing and believing that will fill you with joy. Okay, that I think is his message. And I'm about out of time. I promised you some time. Maybe we'll come back and revisit this. I don't know, but I want to leave time for your questions and comments. So let's pause here.
Could you back up real quick and in verse 3 talk about the word clean again?
Oh, okay. When it's in verse 2 when he says he takes away every branch that in me that does not bear fruit, he takes away, and every branch that bears fruit, he prunes it. The word there is cleanses. The same Greek word is used there. The verb form of the same word that's translated clean in 3, that's the same Greek word, katharos. And it's just a word for clean. It would be the word that you'd use if somebody is kosher, if someone is ritually clean. It can be used to describe moral cleanness, I think. It's used in a variety of different ways. But I'm inclined to take it here, you know, even though it's tempting to see it as in moral and spiritual terms, I think the fact is that he's still in the metaphor. So maybe translate it, you're being pruned, is the idea. Because I'm quite confident that word is what they would use of a branch in a vineyard that you had pruned. It's been cleansed. That now is a clean branch.
Verse 11, when mm-hmm. you're talking about the joy, mm-hmm. you've interpreted that joy as joy that we have now while we're on this earth rather than the joy that is to come when we, after we've died and gone to heaven. Mm-hmm. What makes you take it as joy on this earth rather than joy to come?
Because I think what he's saying in 11 is, why am I telling you this now? Because I want you now to experience the joy that I experience. Because he's explaining to them why he's revealing these truths to them. And I think what makes the most sense is, I'm telling you this because I expect it to engender joy in you right now. If you really grasp what I'm saying, this is a big deal.
Could it also engender faithfulness to stick with the let the line?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's another part of his agenda, is to encourage them, to exhort them to persevere. But as I see the connection, and what's my motive for persevering? Because of the promise before me. And that does two things. It fills me with joy now, and it gives me an incentive to stick with it, to persevere.
You mentioned at the beginning that you can see this passage as a litmus test for how we see the Bible's role in our lives. What do you mean by that?
Okay, that's what I didn't get to. Who knows what's going to happen in the future? But I mentioned this young Hungarian woman. It was very interesting and very sad to watch in our conversation. She was not about to change her interpretation of John 15. She wasn't going to go there. She wasn't even going to consider a different interpretation of John 15. She already knew what was true, and John 15 was her proof text for in which that version of the faith was grounded, and I wasn't going to mess with it. what I would argue is that does not speak well for where she was at that evening. Now, life is long, and it's a long journey, and you would have found me certain evenings being in her shoes, responding exactly the same way she responded. So I'm not saying I know what God has in store for her, but just like the snapshots in me of my life where I was just stubbornly refusing to reconsider. And I have vivid examples of times in my own life where people were teaching me, were trying to get me to see then what I am now teaching you, and I would not buy it. I just wouldn't go there. I refused to see it. And in fairness to me, I mean, I was just confused. I mean, it wasn't obvious to me at the time that I wasn't just being merely stubborn. I just wasn't ready yet. I wasn't ready to go there yet. But there's a kind of hardness, there's a kind of stubbornness that goes along with it that is really dangerous. It's a spiritually bad place to be. And we all have it, but are we going to allow that spiritual hardness to be melted one day? If not, then we are branches who are not abiding in the vine. Because in effect, what we're saying is, I mean, like, take this one for example. If I'm right in my interpretation, for me to come along and take this very passage and turn it into a radically different theology and make that the basis of my Christianity is to do the very thing that Jesus in this passage is warning us not to do. I'm supposed to abide in him, and here I am finding some way to reinvent his teaching and reinvent his gospel. Now, I didn't think that I was doing that early in my life. I thought I was remaining faithful to the teaching of Jesus because I had a whole structure around me, a whole community of people telling me, yeah, you got that right. Yeah, you're on the right track. I agree with that. That makes sense to me. And I listened more to the crowd than I did to the Bible. And that's the thing that I want, we just have to get clear on that. We have to be the kind of people who listen to the Bible courageously. And what I mean by that is we have the integrity to try to decide not what is a plausible interpretation, but what did it mean? You know, what is the Bible actually saying? Not what can I get away with telling you that it says? Because I can get away with a lot, and you can get away with a lot. I mean, there's all kinds of ways that I can make a plausible interpretation, and I go away saying, well, yeah, that's plausible. You can't find fault with me on that. You're right. I can't find fault with you on that, but is that what the text is saying? Is that the truth that we are to abide in? And it's our failure to ask that next question that has caused the greatest harm in evangelical Christianity today. We don't even think it's a fair question. I mean, if you press people on that, they're going to say, well, you know, I mean, the Bible's a hard book and people disagree. We got to cut one another some slack. You know, we got to recognize that there's room for disagreement here. Well, I will be the first to admit that it's really hard to understand the Bible, and it's very important that we do it with humility. But let's not turn humility into sloppiness. Yes, let's be humble, but let's recognize the justice of the question, but is that what it's teaching me? And be prepared to change my mind and turn my whole life upside down if I have to, in order to abide in what Jesus actually taught. And that's what's scary, is when I see people not willing to turn their life upside down in order to abide in what Jesus actually taught. It's like the wine in the new wines and the wineskins. No one, after drinking old wine, wants the new because he says the old is good enough. Well, it's not good enough. A bad but intelligent and plausible interpretation is not good enough. Because I don't know the truth that I'm to abide in if it's not the truth that I'm to abide in. And my life should be a constant, ongoing quest to make sure I got it right, to make sure that I'm actually listening to what it's actually saying. Did I even answer your question? I'm sorry, I just started preaching there.
It sounds like you're saying that if you're not willing to be changed by the text, then you're not approaching it properly.
Right.
But it seemed like everybody would want to say, well, of course, that's what I do.
Yeah. But that's where I want us to pause and look at what we actually do, not what I know that I should do, and know that I mean, all my life I would have said yes, I'm willing to follow the text wherever it goes. But I look back on my life, I see all kinds of evidence I wasn't willing to let go wherever the text led me, all kinds of places where I dug in my heels and wouldn't go, until finally God beat me down. But if I'm honest with myself, I didn't have integrity. And that's what I'm saying, is let's be honest with ourselves. How far does our integrity go here?
Well, if I'm honest, I would have to say I don't really abide in God. And it seems like I look around, I would say that same with most everybody I see, too. So how do you deal with that?
Well, what do you mean, Bruce? In what way do you not?
Well, I feel like I get distracted with things in this world, and I focus more on those things rather than things that are eternal. And I feel like I'm a branch that's sort of hanging on there.
Yeah.
Because there's a part of me that wants to hang on to those things that are eternal, but yeah, I just don't on a very good, consistent basis at all.
Right. Well, of course, what Jesus is saying here, Jesus is describing two kinds of people. So he's speaking in pretty absolute black and white terms here. Our lives are messy enough that the fact of the matter is, yes, all of us get terribly distracted. But there's actually two kinds of distracted people. There are distracted people who, though they are distracted, they have this kind of undissolvable anchor that keeps pulling them back and pulling them in and won't let them ultimately go, won't let them ultimately become detached from this truth. And then there are people who are distracted unto death. That is, that their distraction is so great that there is no attraction of the truth that matches it, that can counter it. But yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, who of us can claim that we're not seduced by all the things that this world has to offer and get wrapped up in it and get distracted by it? All of us do. But if there's anything authentic about our relationship to God, there's something else there too. And that thing that is there, the reality of the gospel, keeps beckoning us. It keeps calling us back. It kind of tethers us and won't let us stray so far that we get lost. And I think that's what Jesus means. I mean, ideally, of course, we would not be distracted at all. But that, given the nature of my blindness and my foolishness and my sinfulness, that's not realistic for me to expect. But Jesus can expect that I won't go away. And that's, I think, what he's saying, is that there are people who go away and there are people who can't go away, and it's only the people who can't go away who are bearing fruit.
So the fruit we bear is the willingness to accept the truth from God, as Jesus has revealed it?
I think it's everything that our sanctification is the fruit. So it's the fact that Jesus teaches us the truth and we believe it. What God's desire is that we be human beings who believe his truth, so my believing it is part of the fruit. God is a merciful God. I am being taught to be merciful. So me seeing attitudes of mercy in my own life, that is a fruit of the Spirit, is part of the fruit. I mean, all the fruits of the Spirit would be included, I think, in this fruit. But it's not just exhausted by the fruit of the Spirit. Everything that God is seeking to accomplish in making me a disciple of Jesus is the fruit that he wants to see.
I just wondered if you knew that the sequel to the prayer of Jabez is on John 15.
Is it really?
Yeah. That's what
I didn't know that. I did not know that.
I haven't read it yet, but...
I'd like... Anyone want to let me place bets on what he says? Right behind you.
I can easily see this passage becoming a touchstone, as you probably remember from our theology before. This passage held a deep sense of our personal attachment to Jesus, and embedded in that was all of the hope for all of the holes in our life.
Right.
And so how you dealt with this was sort of if you didn't treat this passage with the level of personal subjectivity, you know, and the abidingness that we all were trying to nail down. But if you didn't treat that sort of with the kind of respect that this young lady really was implying, then you would be throwing the baby out with the bathwater. I mean, you would be rejecting everything that she really felt about Jesus.
Yeah. I think those were exactly her words to me.
Yeah. Was it really? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I can see this having become such a touchstone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, one more? Okay. Okay. Thanks. Bye.